On this hearing, the Senate Health and Social Services Committee will now come to order. Today is Thursday, January 29th, and the time is 3:31 p.m. We are in the Butrovich Room 205. Members present are Senator Myers, Senator Klayman, Senator Tobin, Vice Chair Giesel, and myself, Chair Dunbar. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Before we begin, I would like to thank Mary Gwen Kawakami, the Senate Health and Social Services Recording Secretary, and Kyla Tupo from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today. We have one item on our agenda today, a presentation from the Department of Health on the Rural Health Transformation Program. With us today, we have Commissioner Heidi Hedberg, Deputy Commissioner Emily Ricci, Associate Director of the Office of Health Savings, Betsy Wood, and Sylvan Robb is also in the room from the Department of Commerce, because we have some questions that are perhaps related to licensure. Commissioner, would you like to come forward and begin your presentation? Oh, I should also acknowledge we have with us Representative Mina, the chair of the Health and House Health and Social Services Committee, with us today. Thank you.
For the record, my name is Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner for the Department of Health. On slide two, on July 4th, H.R. 1 was signed into law that created the Rural Health Transformation Program. It is a federal commitment to fundamentally improve how health care is delivered in Alaska. This is a one-time, five-year investment intentionally designed not to sustain the status quo, but to transform health care delivery, expand access, and improve outcomes. From the outset, we've been very deliberate and collaborative working with Alaskans from across the state in developing the application. The department had a goal that we would be transparent, and we really wanted to ensure that Alaskans saw themselves in this application, that it reflected their challenges, our shared realities, and our collective roles in solutions, and maximizing this opportunity for our state. To that end, we used a work group that is developing into an advisory council. And that includes the Alaska Hospital Association, the Alaska Primary Care Association, the Alaska Native Tribal Health Care Association, the Alaska Municipal League, and the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. They have been instrumental in helping with the development of the application and a true lifeline. At its core, the application is built around three groups who experience the system, the healthcare system, very differently, but are deeply connected. First, it's the patients. It's the people, it's the clients that we serve. And it's really to ensure that Alaskans can have access to care when they need it without that unnecessary travel or delay. It's also to strengthen care so they have it closer to home, where trust, continuity, and outcomes are stronger. For providers, too much of their time is spent navigating avoidable systems that are barriers rather than delivering that whole person care. And I can truly say, you know, many of them come and share that they're entering, you know, patient information into multiple systems because they're not connected, that they're ordering tests or reordering imaging because they don't have access to those images. And it is a very, it's a strong frustration for our providers. And this application was intentionally developed to reduce those administrative frictions so that providers can spend more time with the patients and making clinically informed, timely decisions. And then there's the payers. You know, Medicaid is within the Department of Health, but this also includes Medicare. It includes commercial insurance. The payment structure doesn't align with the way providers want to care for those patients, and we want to use this opportunity to better align reimbursements with the outcomes that we want to see, which is to improve access, quality, and sustainability. At its core, this funding acknowledges that improving rural health care in Alaska is about collaboration, not just a single program or a single agency, but keeping the patient at the center of the conversation. And with that focus, over the course of a very, very intensive 6 weeks, we wrote the application, and on October 29th is when we received our award, which is the amounts reflected on the slide. It's $272 million for the first year. So before us, we truly have an opportunity to incorporate our lessons learned from the past on healthcare reform efforts. We have an opportunity to work together differently and to come together to make the most of this one-time opportunity.
Thank you. If we could pause after each for questions. Thank you, Commissioner. We have one from Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner, the public is listening. I take these meetings and send the recordings out to my constituents. Can you define rural?
Through the chair, Representative Giesel, there are many definitions of rural. For our application, as we defined rural, it really is the state of Alaska. Our healthcare system is a hub and spoke system. So throughout the application, we used terms of rural and frontier to delineate from our smaller villages or smallest communities to our hub communities. But even in Anchorage, which has specialized care, that healthcare system is really integrated. So for the purposes of the application, we define rural as the entire state of Alaska.
Thank you. Just follow up, Mr. Chairman. So the federal government was okay with Anchorage being classified as rural?
Through the chair, Representative Giesel, yes.
Thank you.
Good. A good clarification. I think something that is not intuitive for a lot of folks that weren't familiar with this process. So now I think we are on through any other questions. We're on to slide 3, I believe.
For the record, Heidi Hedberg. So with the foundation that I had shared with you, I think it's now important to really turn and really discuss how was the application technically scored. CMS outlined the criteria for the technical factors that needed to be evaluated in the notice of funding opportunity that all states received. So think of it as a checklist. It's important to note that we had one opportunity to make these decisions. If we had said no to any one of these different elements, we could not go back and change the application because it was a one-time application. And I think that's where it was imperative that we listened to Alaskans and to the associations. And they were very clear that they wanted the Department of Health to submit the most competitive application. With that context, it's helpful to understand there were two broad categories that created the technical score. One was that qualitative, and the qualitative was made up of the goals and the initiatives, and we'll be discussing that slide in just a little bit. The other broad category was the quantitative, and that's how big is our state, the rural, the facilities, the policies. There was a list of qualitative elements. Of those qualitative elements, two of them are policies where it's going to engage the legislature in a conversation. And that's what I want to draw your attention to on slide 3. There, one is scope of practice for pharmacists, and there are 5 different compact licensing that are listed on your screen: emergency medical services, psychologists, physicians, physician assistants, and nurses. It's outlined in the notice of funding opportunity that the conversation we have between now and December 31st, 2027, states were scored if that policy was implemented, a commitment to implement, or was not going to implement. And again, what we heard from our associations was to be competitive. Those point values is what equated to that larger award amount that we received for year one.
Thank you, Commissioner. We have a question from Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you for being here. As Senator Giesel indicated, the public is listening. I can see you have a very packed room behind you. And so there's a lot of curiosity, a lot of questions. And you said a few things that pinged questions for me. So I'm going to ask my first question, and I know we will have many more on this particular slide. And hopefully I can either ask them here on the dais or follow up with you at a later date. But the first one is the mention of this is a one-time application. This was a unique opportunity for us. And I see here that there are legislative priorities or policies that must pass. So I'm curious to know which legislators you talked to and who you discussed these particular pieces of policy with to ensure that if this was going to be a competitive package or a competitive application, you had the votes here in the legislature to pass these particular policies.
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, through the chair, Senator Tobin, this was outside of session. Clearly, this was this fall when we had to develop the application. So there was not specific targeted conversations with the legislature because we wanted to have equal opportunity. We were really relying on the associations and Alaskans to help kind of inform the direction that they wanted to develop the application.
Do you have a follow-up, Senator Tobin?
But I want to make sure.
Okay. I have a question. I'll wait for you. Why don't you ask your follow-up first, and then I'll ask my question.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Dunbar. So with that being said, are there legislators that are going to be prioritizing these? Or are these going to be introduced by the administration? How do we begin to discuss and have dialogue about these particular policies?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, this is the opportunity to have conversations over this session and next session. So it is open.
But you do not have a prime sponsor. You will not be sponsoring.
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, I think we are open.
I'll ask it more directly, just because, you know, in the interest of a collaborative process, is, to your knowledge, is the governor open to introducing these bills?
To the chair, right now, we are literally having conversations to see who is interested in sponsoring or what it looks like in terms of pathway forward. I think first is the opportunity just to educate ourselves on what the compact licensing is and is not.
Very good. So my question is about, if you look at this slide sort of standing on its own, it looks sort of like the application rises and falls on these on us passing these. But I think what you've actually said, and I have some supplementary materials that indicate, this is only a percentage, maybe even a relatively small percentage of our total application. Like you said, there are other things, you know, how big are we? How rural in some cases are we? You know, what are our demographics? That sort of thing. And so I guess my question is, what percent of our score was tied to these particular reform proposals or promises to the federal government?
To the chair, for the record, this is Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health. And we don't know what the exact amount is or the score that is necessarily associated with these policies. And part of that is because of the way that the rural health transformation kind of program in NOFO was developed. And states are consistently kind of scored and ranked against each other almost on a curve, and that will be updated on an annual basis. But we are, you know, again, this has been a very fast process, and I don't want to use that as an excuse, but that's kind of the reality of what we're working through. And it's been fast for us. It's also been fast for CMS. And they are working to develop kind of answers and responses to the different questions we have. So we don't know what that amount is. If we did, we would share it.
So I have a document here from CMS from November 5th, the Rural Health Transformation Program opportunity number. It's got a number there. I'm sure you're familiar with it. I think it might have been you might have distributed it at some point, but it has, and we'll put it on the website. It has here these percentages. For example, scope of practice, 1.75%. Licensure compacts, 1.75%. Short-term limited duration insurance, 1.75%. Can you sort of explain to the public, what does that 1.75% mean? as you understand it? Is it, does it mean that licensure compacts as a whole equate to 1.75% of the points we were to receive, or 1.75% of the money we were to receive? What does that mean exactly?
For the record, this is Betsy Wood, Associate Director at the Office of Health Savings. I think that's a really great question, and it's honestly a difficult one to answer, because I think if you look at the Notice of Funding Opportunity, which I believe is the document that you have, there were multiple pieces in there that talk about it's 1.7. Without having it in front of me, I'm hesitant to quote from it, but there are components of scoring that were these data-driven pieces, right? So I think some of it may be how big is your state, where are your rural populations. And then when it comes to these policy commitments, it's a percentage of a component of the score. And I'll be honest, I think we've been trying to unpack too, what does that look like and what does that translate to? And as Deputy Commissioner Ricci mentioned, our understanding is that states are essentially graded on a curve against each other, and they are stacked and regraded against each other every time the funds are looked at for the next year. So that's where it really does become, I think, a pretty tricky math problem to pinpoint what this is. And again, if we could say specifically what that percentage equates to on a dollars amount, we certainly would.
Okay. Well, I think that we've got some more slides here that might be more appropriate to have this discussion, but we've got a question from Senator Klayman.
So when you talk, and I'm looking at all three of you because I'm not sure who's best to answer this. If we're talking about a sliding scale, let's say you have five states and all five states in their initial score got 100%. So they all got their money. And then at the end of 2027, they all didn't quite check all the boxes, and some of them had 95%, some of them were 90%, maybe one of the five, and I'm just picking five because it's one of them still keeps 100%, and the others, you know, 85%, 90%, 95%. What happens? Do they get whatever that percentage clawed back, and who gets the money if it gets clawed back?
For the record, this is Emily, through the chair, Senator Klayman. For the record, this is Emily Ricci with the Department of Health. Again, our understanding is that every year, right, that kind of review and ranking of milestones and other elements of the application will occur, and then CMS will announce, I believe it's around October 30th of every year, what the new award amount, the updated award amount is for future years. And that award amount, our understanding, again, this will change. We'll share with you what we know, but this can change sometimes week by week. It can be based on whether we completed the milestones in our application, whether we expended the funds within the time period. And then again, when that ranking is complete, they will compare states against each other, states that maybe did not obligate all of their funds. Those funds will be taken for future years and redistributed to other states. So there is the ability to either, I think, be in a position where more funds are awarded for forward years, or funds are reduced for future years. That's our understanding now, but I will let Betsy Wood make.
Yeah, and for the record, Betsy Wood, and through the chair, I think it's important to think about when we're thinking about the funding that was allocated based off of the policy commitments that were made. That is an area where our understanding today is that if those policy commitments are not followed through on, then CMS can look and say, here's how much money was allocated based off of that commitment. The state didn't meet that commitment. We would like that amount of funding back. And then as DC Ricci mentioned, there is an annual process that the state will go through every year where we say, you know, we do our reporting, we provide information to CMS, we work with them throughout the year, throughout our cooperative agreement. They look at our progress. They say, how are you meeting your milestones? What does this look like? And then that's where they kind of rescore and re-rank these applications, or regrade, I guess, on the curve against each other. And that's where our future funding may look a little bit different than the amount that we got today. And that's going to be based off of our progress and other states' progress. So that's a separate process. But this piece of we would like that portion of funding back, that's, to my understanding, that's a process that CMS will go through December 31st, I think there's a few staggered dates for kind of when they'd like to see these policy commitments enacted by. And so at that moment in time, that's when they do a look back. There's another process, and I do think we may touch on it in a future slide, but I'll describe it now because I think it's appropriate, which is at the end of each budget period. So each year is a budget period. You have a year to spend your fund or to allocate your funds. You have another year to finish spending. At the end of that, you know, spend window for each budget period, CMS will look across all states and say what funds are left unspent. And then they will sweep those and they will redistribute those across states. We don't really know a lot about how many states will receive redistributed funds, where will they go, but those are kind of three separate pieces to be thinking about when you think about how the funds may flow. I hope that's helpful.
I've got a question, and then a question for Senator Tobin, then we'll hopefully go to the next slide. But I just want to be sure. You said policy commitments, and policy commitments is not synonymous with legislative action, correct? That is, there are policy changes that the department is going to make separate from the request of the legislature. Is that true?
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, yes, that's true. There's eight different policies, and that's the term that's used in the notice of funding opportunity. Of those eight different policies, two of them is a conversation with the legislature to make a decision. The remaining six can be accomplished through updating regulations and or just funding.
Very good. Thank you. Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And that is where my question is going to be directed to. And I do want to say that it's an incredible application. You guys did incredible work. I was there when you were submitting it. The joy I felt from you was palatable. And so I do applaud you for that work. I also recognize the different roles that we serve. And we are here and hopefully asking questions so the public have the information and are aware, but also so that we can ensure that Alaska over the next 5 years is able to capture the most amount of resource that will benefit the communities in which we represent. So my question really is, in this slide, as you've mentioned, there are two policy areas that need legislative action. But outside of that, for $270 some odd million each year for 5 years, which I'm not great at math, so I'm not going to try to say what the total amount is, that's a lot of resource that the legislature has no input in. I am curious about some of the dynamics that you see coming down, especially when it comes to creating new pathways or new programs or new departments and the ongoing support after 5 years that you may need from the legislature, and yet there is very little buy-in here at the very beginning for us. So can you speak a little bit about kind of the way that you envision that or the way that you hope that we go forward together at this point, again, as there was very little input from lawmakers on the initial application?
For the record, Heidi Hedberg through the chair, Senator Tobin. I think this is a great example of building the plane as we fly. So I think that at the very beginning, when we learned about this in July, it was like, let's get an RFI. We are going to be committed to working with Alaskans. And then it was crafting a very competitive application. And now we are looking at next steps. And again, we're looking at, and that's where I kind of started on the prior slide. We need to work differently together. I think working together to use this one-time funding to address the systemic issues that we have seen with patients and their patient stories, with providers looking at our Medicaid program and the changes that need to happen. I think this is how we're going to work differently together. It's not written out yet. I think this is very much of the beginning of the conversation.
Very good. Let's move on to the next slide. We've got 15 slides here and a lot of good information.
For the record, this is Emily Ricci with the Department of Health. So when we talk about transforming the healthcare system, I mean, that is a huge, laudable goal. But, you know, what does that look like and what is our approach? You've heard Commissioner Hedberg earlier talk about kind of like our North Star or our vision, and that is that Alaska has the best rural healthcare system in the nation, and I would love to say the world. And we have elements of that already, but how can we bolster that across our state? And when we step back, we think about, I think about what do people experience? And I think there's a lot of kind of confusion and frustration sometimes from people trying to navigate the system. It's fragmented. It is complex. And so how do we think about increasing healthcare access across the full life spectrum, right? Starting from prenatal care all the way through to our seniors and our elders. What supports that? And it is kind of that next tier is like what enables the system? And, you know, what will enable that access across the healthcare system is our workforce. Our people are our most valuable resource, and we need to be able to support them. And how can we leverage technology and try innovative approaches in order to, again, expand the ability of our workforce to provide the healthcare access that we need? And then finally, how is that system sustained? Again, when I step back and I think about the challenges in the system today, I feel like people are very confused. It can be like hard to navigate the system, frustrating for providers because they're not able to always spend their time focusing on patient care versus administrative duties. And then it's very expensive. And for the amount of money that we are paying into the system, I think we can all agree we don't always feel like we're getting the outcomes that we need. And I see providers who are not always reimbursed for the community care that they're providing or the way that they are trying to meet their patients' needs. So how can we look at a sustainable system where kind of how we're paying for that system reflects the work that the providers are doing and the outcomes we want to see? So we use...
Senator Giesler.
Again, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am concerned about what we're aiming at. So your first bullet says ensure Alaskans get affordable care. What will that look like? What is affordable? Do you have data right now that says primary care at this level of cost is affordable and will keep providers here in Alaska? We used to have studies from Milliman who defined some of this. Do you have a consultant now that is defining this?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. That is part of what we need to build out, and that is some of what we can use these funds to do. There are many, many studies, and I know, Senator, you've looked at many of those that have, you know, been underway for, I mean, since I started in this probably 13 years ago. Some of those are still relevant. Many are outdated and need to be updated. So we've been having many conversations. I mean, we've been talking with ICER. ICER produced some pretty remarkable reports when I started in 2012 and 2013, looking at the cost of healthcare across the system. Is there an opportunity to update those reports? So we are trying to work and bring in the technical assistance we need. Again, this came very quickly. And so this is where we need to work with stakeholders and, quite frankly, the legislature in identifying, like, what are some concrete goals to meet over the next 5 years? What are some of those metrics? We have metrics in the application, but those were really, and they're important metrics, but those were framed in the context of, like, specific requirements and competitiveness. They may be a little bit different than what we as a state decide we want our healthcare system to be measured by and what we want that to look like. So do I have those updated today? No, but that is something that we know we need to do very quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. If you want to continue either with this slide or to the next slide.
So moving on to slide 5, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. So when we take this vision, high-level vision, and we try to kind of pare that down into goals and funding initiatives within the proposal, we talk about three different goals. The first is to promote the lifelong health and well-being for Alaskans. The second is to build sustainable outcome-driven health systems. And the third is to drive workforce and technology innovations. And this is within the application. Within those three goals, there are 6 proposed funding uses, and those are represented by the multicolored boxes within the goals. Each of those proposed funding uses, to me, is kind of the like a core element of the application. Those reflect the information that we received and the feedback we received from providers through the request for information process. And they have been heavily edited line by line by many different stakeholders. Here on the PowerPoint slide, they seem very simple. There are actually 20 pages with different proposed funding uses and then some specific examples with broad language underneath. The way that we tried to craft our approach to the application was to almost to take an umbrella approach, because again, we're trying to think about how to craft an application that will survive administration changes, survive election cycles, and basically be as useful to our healthcare community half a decade from now as it is today. So you'll see in the, under the proposed funding uses, specific examples followed by broad language. So for example, under goal one, I think about goal one as focusing on the people. And within that, we have three different proposed funding uses. So healthy beginnings, healthcare access, and healthy communities. And so within that, some of the specific examples under the proposed funding uses for healthy beginnings include space renovations to support labor delivery and birthing centers, or investing in remote fetal monitoring devices, because we know there's some organizations that believe that could be helpful to mothers, or enhancing maternal and child health visiting programs. Again, those are just some of the examples. There are many more. Under healthcare access, we focused on increasing access to the full spectrum of behavioral health services. We know that upgrading and expanding specialized EMS equipment is a need that we've heard from the communities, or bolstering home and community supports. If we think about healthy communities, we look at community programs to help manage chronic disease. And we also heard from our tribal health partners that traditional healing is an important area of focus. So this slide is very simple, but the content within these really reflects the different needs that we heard throughout the state.
Is your question? Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to ask a question about capacity. I've been given notice that some of our early learning programs have had their funding cut in our pre-K system. I'm very concerned about our parents as teachers, our infant learning. These are things that we have been doing well that we are currently poorly doing. And I see here, and I know part of the Rural Health Transformation Fund is about new action, new activities. And so I'm curious, within the capacity of the department, how are we going to ensure that we don't continue to backslide on evidence-based proven interventions that we have been doing, but yet we're no longer doing, as we try to stand up some of these new innovative ideas or programs and then get them with the current burnout staff that we are all trying to work with?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. You know, when this first came out, we went to a number of different stakeholders and we said we have to do things differently because the department on its own, we can provide that foundation and that support for the changes we need to see in the system. But ultimately, like, you will be the ones that are doing the work and that are implementing this. And so to your question, we can't do it by ourselves. We have to, and we're trying to make sure that we can use this funding to support our partners in building out those services. One area that we do clarify with CMS is if we have a program that is a best practice, right, or is evidence-based, and we have not been able to expand it because of funding restrictions, would that expansion be eligible for these funds? And the answer is yes. And so we'll talk about some of the restricted fund uses in further slides. But again, the intent is to is not to supplant existing programs, but we can support expansion, especially if there are things we're doing in one area that could really be modeled in other areas and expanded. So I don't know if that fully answers your question, but that's how we're trying to approach this.
Senator Giesel and then Senator Meyer.
So Commissioner or Deputy Commissioner, are you working with the Division of Insurance? And the reason I ask this is these are great ideas. Let's get some new technology. Who's going to reimburse this? Is Primera on board with this? That's one of the barriers we face, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Through the chair, Senator Giesel. You know, I think it's hard to say yes, an entity is on board without knowing what exactly it is specifically we're talking about regarding the intervention, right? I think in general, our expectation is that if entities want to try new technologies that result in cost savings, that we build out reimbursement for that because it creates cost savings in the future. And so one area and that we can talk about, or I think is a good example, is like remote patient monitoring. So are there opportunities to support remote patient monitoring for specific types of patients? I think about congestive heart failure. Is there a way to support them and to reduce the readmissions that they may experience? That results in cost savings to the health insurance plan, but ultimately and most importantly, it helps the patient stay healthier and supports the providers in that practice. That's one area that right now is not reimbursed by Medicaid. And I'm not sure if that's reimbursed by Premera or other third-party administrators. But you could use these funds to pilot a program like that to see if it works, and then eventually to build that out further and build in reimbursement in something like the Medicaid program. Other states cover it through Medicaid. We don't right now, partly because we want to be very thoughtful about any services we expand, and we haven't had the opportunity to test out some of these pilots. So this fund can give us the chance to build and test those out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So kind of touched on this a little bit in the last couple of questions, but you got fiscal sustainability on the slide here. And, you know, kind of my biggest concern with this program moving into it, and I've had a couple conversations with you already about this, but is, you know, we don't want to set ourselves up for standing up new programs or expanding capacity. And then in 5 years when the money's gone now, you know, we've got these things set up and, you know, now we need more money to sustain it. And, you know, as the old saying goes, you know, predictions are hard, especially about the future. And, but I'm going to just go out on a limb here and say in 5 years, we're probably not going to have $270 million laying around in the state budget to, you know, go back and keep doing this. So can you give me some specifics about what you're doing in terms of how you're talking to different providers to make sure that, that what we're doing with this money is something that is sustainable in the long run, and they'll be able to wean themselves off of this money by the end of the 5 years?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. We have been really thinking about that. That's been a focus of ours. Again, we've had experience with other large amounts of money coming into the state, and how do we learn from the pitfalls we've experienced and avoid that? And so from the very beginning with the evaluation process or with any sort of funding proposals or requests from providers, a sustainability plan has to be part of that as part of the evaluation criteria. And we have been communicating from the beginning that this is not intended to replace operating costs. This is intended to provide investments in the system that are necessary, but we otherwise would not necessarily have the funding to achieve in order to improve the system efficiency and ultimately allow it to provide better care. Commissioner?
Okay.
Very good. I have a question. But I think you've touched on goal one, goal two. I'll let you talk to goal three first, and then I've got a question for you.
For the record, this is Emily Ricci. So goal three, again, I think about as kind of the tools or the methods that we have available to achieve goal one and goal two, right? And again, it is strengthening the workforce. That is probably the number one challenge that we heard across the spectrum from healthcare providers. And as we think about our aging population and we think about demographics in general, I think those challenges will continue to be more acute. So how can we focus on that, and how can we leverage different programs? And I don't think there's one solution. I think we've been looking at this issue from different perspectives for a long time. This is not a new issue, but it's become acute. And so some of the ideas that we have or that were put forward by our different stakeholders, as well as looking at other states, are things like expanding, grow our own programs, right? Thinking about upskill or reskill programs. So if you are maybe mid-career and you're interested in moving into the healthcare field, how can we help you move into the healthcare field? What are some of the paths that we could create to do that? Or if you want to improve increase kind of the level at which you are practicing, how can we make that available? We know that residency programs and expanding residency programs is a key challenge in the state, and one that we would like to address using the Rural Health Transformation Program. We especially hear that among our family practice physicians. So those are some examples of strengthening the workforce.
So I have a question. It's the last bullet there, spark technology and innovation. And it's a sort of practical question going to what Senator Tobin asked about the relationship between the department, the legislature, and this money. So a couple of years ago, we had a crisis around SNAP, and the Department of Health came to the legislature. We worked together to get money so you could upgrade your sort of back office IT, which was incredibly out of date. We all know the story. So the two questions are, one, could that upgrade have been paid with these funds? Could we have done that upgrade with these funds? And then two, does that mean we need to put a line item in our budget for it? Or if the legislature feels that you need something in particular, can we say we're putting it into the budget and the money is going to come from these funds?
To the chair, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. To that first question about could these funds, like if we had that same need today, could these funds be used to meet that need? The answer is no, because those funds are available through existing funding programs like Medicaid, where there is a federal match available, and or SNAP. So there is very clear direction from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services that these funds are not intended to supplant existing funding streams. We are talking with other departments to understand what their needs are, because there are a number of other systems that are a number of other needs across departments that may not have available revenue streams to support some of those systems' needs, right? Like we think about children in the office in care of the state, right? Or some of the other needs from our correction system. So we are having those discussions. So to your first question, again, that is one of the challenges with the funding, is that it really cannot supplant funding that is available through existing programs to meet needs. In regards to the second question, I'm not a budget expert or a technician. In general, this fund is crafted to be a grant. And so the same way that we would use or engage with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services on other grants, that's how this funding is coming through. So it's very different than the funding that was available through COVID and the ARPA periods. It is established through a collaborative agreement, and we have a number of like very comprehensive requirements that we need to meet in order to receive approval from our team with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to actually release the funds. And I think we're going to talk about that a little bit later on in the presentation.
Okay. All right. Don't see any questions. Please go on to the next slide.
Moving on to slide 7, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. So as I just stated, this is a federal grant. And so it is structured as a federal non-construction grant, which will be important when we talk about limited fund uses. So the funding can be used within the context of the cooperative agreement, and that cooperative agreement reflects the requirements in the notice of funding opportunity, as well as the purposes approved in the application, which again is why we tried to take an umbrella approach with the application, so that again we were specific enough to be competitive but broad enough to give space, because the time frame for responding to this was so short. All funding must be approved and reviewed by CMS ultimately before it is released, and this is a cooperative agreement. The Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services works with the Department of Health throughout the project, like we do with other federal grants, not just at award time. So we have regular communication, planning, and input. They review and approve key activities, our budget, our performance measures, the personnel who can be funded or supported, as well as the administrative costs through this grant. They do provide technical assistance and evaluation support, and we actually were part of a meeting earlier today for all states where they kind of did their kickoff meeting. And then we can collaborate on adjustments to the work plan if needed, but those have to occur kind of within the confines and the boundaries of the notice of funding award and the boundaries of the initial application. So moving on to slide 8, there are limits on the funding that's available through the Rural Health Transformation Program. Again, this is considered a non-construction grant by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And so that prohibits the construction of new facilities or building expansions. We understand that renovations are possible with this. And again, we included those throughout our proposed funding uses because we know that that is a barrier to expanding access to care in many different communities or within different provider types. We don't have a lot of guidance right now on what the boundaries are for the definition of renovations. And at different points, we've heard very, very wide and different definitions for what could be allowable. Some are very narrow, some are very wide. That is an area that we are focusing on and having conversations about. We know that we are not the only state, but I want to make sure I share that with the committee because that's a point of frustration that we have heard from providers as they're trying to think about what kind of projects could fit within this grant. We are, the grant can also not be used for purchasing land or other buildings. We've had questions about whether renting or leasing space is an option. We've also had questions, and we're, again, we've put this in with CMS about whether purchasing or leasing a plane or a boat is an option. Again, as people think about how to bring care to rural communities, we like to remind CMS that Alaska is different, and we've invited them to come visit. So this third bullet talks about funding clinical services that are already covered by insurance. And again, that can be very broad if you think about what insurance covers across the nation. But again, I go back to the example that I used when I was describing remote patient monitoring with Medicaid, right? Medicaid, Alaska's Medicaid program today does not cover remote patient monitoring. However, we do believe funds would be available to demonstrate or pilot remote patient monitoring project using the Rural Health Transformation Program that we could then build into coverage in the future if it proved to provide cost savings and was successful. Very important, the funds are intended not to supplant existing funding, and we have seen a very strict line taken on that from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Broadband infrastructure, including internet installation costs and certain telecommunications equipment, is also prohibited. We have some asks then about Starlink and about the actual purchase of satellites, especially if you're thinking about care in rural Alaska. We are not the only state with that question in, but we don't have any clear guidance yet. Provider loan repayments are prohibited through this. However, retention and relocation and retention incentives can be provided through the Rural Health Transformation Program. So again, some of this is very nuanced in terms of how you would be thinking or shaping the program. Direct payments to individuals are not allowed, so no gift cards, no cash assistance. Again, we cannot use this to supplant the state's Medicaid match, and direct food purchasing is also prohibited.
Senator Klayman.
So on this question of thoughts, there seems to be a nuance in one of the early questions you testified that a program that works, we could do more of it. But it sounds like you can't use the money to pay for what you're already doing. But if you're doing more of it, which sounds like something that may actually also be paid by insurance, but you're trying to expand. So it sounds like some of these are actually not a lot of gray area in how it fits together. Is that accurate? Or
through the chair, Senator Klayman, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. I would say that's accurate. Again, everyone is moving very quickly with this, and I think the CMS team is also working to kind of build out some of these boundaries. I think good communication with them helps them consider our perspective and really the value of ideas that we may have and how those actually promote the object of their program. And so those conversations, I think, can be really helpful in clarifying like why something may be appropriate, even if it's in a gray area. So there are areas in our proposed application where we're pushing the boundaries specifically relating to child care and workforce housing. We know that those are important needs in our communities. We also know that you are not allowed to use this for housing or for direct child care. But we did include some of those in our proposed funding uses because there may be kind of ancillary programs or opportunities we can develop that also help meet those needs.
What about something like you spoke about renovation. What about something like upgrading the insulation, you know, improving for a healthcare facility or even, you know, like you said, a childcare facility, improving the for heat retention, something like that. Would that fit in these kind of funds?
To the chair, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. I think the extent of what defines renovation is still something we're getting clarity on. We know of several entities that really want to integrate primary care into some of their work. And to do that, they're looking at renovating space. And so our ask is this aligns with system transformation, the integration of primary care with other services. Can we use these funds to help renovate those spaces? And we don't have clarity quite yet on what the boundaries of those are. And I just mentioned that because insulation could be part of what those renovations need in order to be successful. So we're trying to get clarity on that.
Okay. All right. I'm going to move on to the next slide.
Okay. For the record, this is Betsy Wood. I will be kind of covering briefly the funding timeline. I think we discussed this a little bit earlier in the presentation, but I think one of the key takeaways here is that this is one-time funding. I think we're all acutely aware of that. And, you know, it's helpful to be looking into the future to see when is the sunset date for this? When does this program end? So that as we start to build out programs and our partners start to build out programs, we can be thinking about what does that sustainability and that glide path look like towards the end of this, and how do we leverage our dollars in between? So, you know, I think you've heard us say multiple times that this has been a really fast and furious effort to stand up, understand what the opportunity is, stand up an application, and then move through implementation, both on our side and on CMS's side. I think that breakneck pace may continue in that every year that we are awarded funds, we'll be awarded funds annually for the next 5 years. We are awarded the funds, and then we have that year and the following federal fiscal year to finish expending that kind of first bucket of funds before we move into the next. So you can see on the screen how these pieces stack together. But we'll be working really closely with CMS and with our partners to kind of distribute funds and start to make movement on progress so that we can really fully leverage this opportunity.
All right.
Moving on to slide 10, I'll reiterate, I think what we've said before, which is that this is really an Alaska-led program with a statewide reach. Our goal is to strengthen Alaska's healthcare system as a whole, and that system's connected and serves the entire state. So the Rural Health Transformation Program is built on that collaboration and those partnerships that we have across states. So organizations anywhere in Alaska may apply if their projects meet the program goals. So they need to demonstrate how their projects will meet those program goals and the state priorities and show how that work can be sustained after funding ends. I think one of the really, you know, wonderful opportunities that we've seen related to partnerships with this is we've started to pull together our stakeholders and our partners across the state through convenings. We've seen organizations that have long worked closely together realize that maybe, oh, we've been working on the same thing, but we've been working in parallel. And new partnerships and new opportunities have arisen where people are saying, oh, I had no idea that you had this same concern about care coordination and referral patterns. We're working on something too. Can we work together and make sure that we're all aligned? So we're seeing some new partnerships arise, which is really promising. And we've also heard that our partners are asking the state to assist in some of that coordination and connection and start to build out opportunities as we see, you know, what do our community partners want to do with these funds? What are their projects? How does that align with each other and maybe play matchmaker in a way where we can start to connect entities together so that we really can start to work together in different ways?
So I have a couple of questions on this slide. The first is... we've spoken about this before, but again, some of this is for the public that's hearing about this for the first time. How much of the money can you use for administrative costs, for your own administrative costs to administer these funds? And then second, how do organizations apply for these funds? If they have to apply for you, do you have an online portal or will you set one up? And then related to that, how would organizations even sort of find out about this? So let's say you're the Lower Kuskokwim School District or something, you know, and that's actually a very large, sophisticated organization, but a similar organization, how are we going to push it out to them that there's this opportunity for them to apply?
Through the chair, these are great questions. First is, you know, for the administrative piece, there are some predetermined caps on certain types of uses of funds that some came from the enabling statute, some were, you know, articulated in the CMS notice of funding opportunity, and administrative expenses are one of those. There's a 10% cap overall on how how much of that overall award can go to administrative expenses. So that's something when we think about what does the state need in order to stand up some of this, and you'll see a lot of this on later slides too, but you know, who do we need to partner with to help us administer these funds? That how do we, you know, work with subrecipients, community subrecipients who say, I would like to do a project and I believe that this funding aligns. That's where, you know, we'll use administrative dollars to help kind of make sure that this program works. And to that end, you know, we have 10% of the funds that can be addressed to that. And we're, as we start to plan and work with CMS to articulate, you know, here's how we see these funds being distributed, particularly in the first year, we are classifying, you know, planned uses of funds as this is an administrative expense. The department needs to build capacity to run this. We need to partner with, you know, a subrecipient administrator to help us with this. Those are administrative type dollars. So there's 10% cap there. Your next question is, you know, how will people apply? I think you'll hear more about that on a later slide. We will be standing up a portal, a web-based portal, where entities can register. They can say, here's my information. They can provide us with a letter of intent that provides us with some information about their project so that we can help understand what's the best funding pathway for you, how can we get you connected into the right opportunity. And again, you will see that a little bit on later slides. And then we're stealing a lot of thunder because I think that one of the big questions is how do people find out about this? We do have a slide on this later, but we are using our website. We have a Rural Health Transformation Program page on our website that is dedicated to this. And we're updating it as frequently as we can. I think you've heard that, you know, we're building the plane as we are flying it. And as we build out new parts, we try to tell people about those new parts and put them on our website in real time so people can understand what are we doing, what are these opportunities. We also have a listserv that people can sign up for so you can be notified if we update our website and you can get our emails that we send out too. We have, you know, just a few weeks ago, we pulled together in a very short period of time, a statewide convening in Anchorage where we reached out to partners and said, we would like to come together in person and talk about, you know, here's what we know today. Here's how, here's the program as it unfolded. Here's how we've built out the application. Here's how you can partner. Here's how you can get engaged. And we're going to continue to build out opportunities for convenings and planning and bring communities together so people can start to think about, or I guess at this point, it's really continue to think about what could this funding do in my community and in my region and how can we partner statewide. I also will say that when the opportunity first, you know, kind of unfolded in July, we really quickly worked to put out a request for information to start to gather information from our partners across the state. And we also have been conducting many, many, many meetings one-on-one with our associations and stakeholders and entities that work with us to say, here's what we know, what are you hearing, what are your questions, and we've continued to do that throughout the process.
Very good. Any other questions on the slide? Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Wood, a few minutes ago, you said that the applicants would need to explain how what they are proposing would be sustained after the funding ended. And that's a great goal. But at this point, many providers are waiting to hear about the rebasing of Medicaid reimbursement. And the Division of Insurance, about a year ago, removed the 80th percentile rule without setting a minimum reimbursement. Consequently, contracts with healthcare providers have been decimated, and they're being reimbursed at about 149% or 150% of Medicare. Unsustainable. How are they to foretell how they will sustain something 5 years from now with this kind of chaos in reimbursement?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. Speaking to the Medicaid program, I think we presented to this committee last year, we began working on phase one of a rate methodology study to really review the underlying methodologies for specific types of Medicaid rates. And we prioritized behavioral health, long-term care services and supports. transportation. Initially, we started with emergent, but we or not emergent, but we pulled in emergent because we heard that need, and federally qualified health centers. And three of those studies are complete and posted. The fourth should be very soon, and I believe we'll be presenting that to the legislature at some time in the next few weeks. But our intent with those studies was really to look at, again, is what we are paying for Medicaid services, does that actually align with, one, the outcomes we want to see, but also the goals of the program and the costs that providers are undertaking. And there are recommendations within each one of those rate methodologies that I think are going to be important for us to review and talk about. And we look forward to working with the legislature to understand what are some of the key changes we may want to make now, and how do we kind of phase out incorporating some of those other key changes in the future. So we don't know everything now. I have a hard time sometimes predicting 5 days, let alone 5 years. So we don't have perfect information today, but we do know that we need to start with this process, and we are asking entities. They may not know exactly how it will be sustained 5 years from now, but we want to make sure that they are thinking about that, and that you know, they have some thought at the very beginning for what that will look like.
Senator Giesel.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. It is true that a third of the population benefits from Medicaid, but two-thirds do not. Two-thirds are either in private insurance or uninsured. And so that's the source of my previous question. Are you working with the Division of Insurance? So I would suggest there needs to be a broader discussion than just Medicaid reimbursement. Thank you.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'm looking at this potential funding recipient slide, and I know you have a follow-up slide regarding some of your partners, and I keep thinking of something my mom would say to me as a child, which is haste breeds holes. When we're going quickly, we sometimes make missteps or we forget certain pieces. And far be it from me to castigate any group here as doing anything in a malicious tent or nefariously. I know there's forces outside of your control, particularly with the haste dynamic. But I see all these different groups, and I'm curious of how do we as Alaskans find out what funding they received, how they spent those funds, were there misuses of those funds, did the state provide oversight and guidance, and in times and instances where there is missteps, what is the reclamation process, what are those guardrails that are hopefully being built into the system or already have been considered? Because we know from the pandemic, we learned lots of lessons about getting dollars out quickly and what happens. And I've been listening to some of our federal partners castigate our healthcare community and certain folks in negative lights. And I would hope that we are not falling into that particular trap again.
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, through the chair, Senator Tobin, you raise many good questions. And we don't know what we don't know unless we partner together and we work differently together so that we can make sure that we're making the best informed decisions with the information that we have at this time. I would say there's a keen interest in terms of the application process, which we're going to move to and discuss, but truly, like, what is funded? And so that's where we keep driving people back to our website, because it is our intent that we're going to be providing summaries of the projects that are happening across the state, because what we are experiencing, and I think that Betsy Wood has shared this, is there's some aha moments of like, oh, I'm working on this project, I'm struggling with this idea, but I see that you're doing it. How can we work together or take and apply what's working in this community and apply it into another community? So our intent is that we're going to be continuing to eventually we'll have a dashboard on our website that reflects the funding, how it looks across the state, how it is being used, aligning to the initiatives, aligning to the goals. What are the outcomes from the funding? Looking at the return on investment, talking a lot about sustainability. I mean, there's a lot of conversations about how are we going to sustain this work. Part of that is the recognition that we have to change the way we're working. And so I think that we are in the development of the evaluation. We're going to have a contractor that will be evaluating this work. And then our intent is that we're going to post it on our website. And just as a follow-up, Senator Giesel, yes, we are working with the Division of Insurance. I think when we look at the second goal and we look at the fiscal sustainability of Medicaid, but also access to health insurance, I think those are conversations that we have started, but we recognize that's a year like 2, 3, 4. That's not a year one, because right now we truly are just trying to build up the infrastructure and make sure, again, to the chair, your comment of like, is everyone aware? We want to make sure that we're inclusive so everyone is aware of this opportunity.
Yes, Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this might be directed to you and the folks who serve on the budget subcommittee. It would be helpful if every year the legislature was able to see the funds granted to organizations, the projects that were funded, the expenditures that were made. This is public dollars, and the public has a right to know where every single penny is going.
Thank you. I guess to respond to that, Commissioner, I was going to ask a question later on about reporting requirements to CMS, but also were you planning on putting forward maybe an annual report on this? And then the contractor for evaluation, the dashboard, the report, can you use these dollars for that as part of the administrative costs?
For the record, Heidi Hedberg to the chair, the answer is yes.
Okay, very good.
To the chair, yes. To you for the record, this is Emily Ricci. I would add that we are also going to be contracting with an independent evaluator over the course of the project. So again, they can help evaluate the outcomes from the different projects and how they align with our goals. We will also be getting their support to with the compliance and the reporting requirements, and all of this will be publicly available like any other public fund. I think our intent actually is to make it more accessible through the dashboard than what we necessarily have right now. I'm flashing back to our giant grant books that is published annually, and I think we'd like to have something that's a little more interactive and is updated more frequently.
Very good. Let's move on to slide 11. We have a few more slides. We have about 20 minutes left, and these are very dense and interesting slides. I'm very curious, first of all, what a sub-recipient administrator, who that actually is. But why don't we just start on this on this slide?
Sure. And for the record, this is Betsy Wood. I think we can start with who is the sub-recipient administrator. We are thrilled that we were able to announce that we've partnered with the Alaska Community Foundation to help us work with community organizations and hospitals and healthcare providers to help manage that community piece of the funding. And I do think that it's helpful to think about how will this money, how are we planning for it to kind of move? And it's, some of it will come, into the state. The Department of Health is the, the lead agency for this. We work with CMS. But we do need some of those administrative dollars to stand up some of those pieces that we've just talked about in order to make all of this run. We are thinking that, there are certainly opportunities for other state agencies to leverage these dollars in ways expand and to grow and to fill needs that they've identified. But we're really thinking that the primary majority of this money is intended for Alaskans and is intended to be distributed throughout the community. And that's where, working with the Alaska Community Foundation, they have a track record of moving, programs that have a large amount of money to distribute in short timeframes, and they've done that very well. They're deeply rooted in the community, and it's really important to us. I think we've said this multiple times, but it's very important to us that this program stays Alaskan-led. I think there are Alaskans really know what we need, and we know how we work well together, and so that was important to us too. So moving on to slide 12, I'll talk a little bit about the funding pathways that we're building out. Again, talking about understanding that Alaskans have very specific needs. I think that all of the entities that we envision benefiting from these funds come at different stages of readiness. I think that we all have been talking about, what does it look like to administer a large federal program that has a lot of reporting requirements and has a lot of strings attached, and smaller entities, that can be a daunting task to look ahead and to say, am I prepared even just with my administrative pieces to understand what it means to apply as a subrecipient, right? These are words that mean certain things in certain places, but people are saying, I have this idea. I would like to make it a reality. I think this is an opportunity for me, but I don't know if my organization is ready for that. We are building out an administrative readiness, kind of grant pathway so that entities can look at those, and those are administrative dollars, right, to say, can I get myself administratively ready in order to engage in this program? And then the next funding pathway that we are looking at are planning grants. I think of that as entities that have an idea or a concept, but maybe it's not fully fleshed out. Maybe they need to build some partnerships. Maybe they need to put some shape around it so that they can say, here's what this would look like, fully packaged and ready to go. So we're building out a planning grant pathway for organizations that need that sort of support. Then our third pathway is looking at project implementation. So I look at that as an entity says, I have a project that is ready to go. It meets, you know, it aligns with the initiatives and the potential uses of funds that are in the application. And I have a really strong sense of what it's going to be. I'm ready. That's a project implementation grant. That would be probably a more involved application than maybe the other pieces, because we do need to communicate back to CMS. Here's what this project's going to look like. And, you know, I think earlier we were talking about what does it look like to do, you know, renovations or infrastructure pieces. And I think that CMS has said they're prepared to work with the state and to work with potential subrecipients to really understand what's in a project and see how it fits. And that may be where we do this, is within that project implementation, where you may say, I have this renovation need, and part of it is you know, upgrading the insulation so that it fits, you know, the community where I am. We may need to work with CMS, so we may need more details from applicants, and that's where we're looking for, you know, project implementation pathway will be a little bit more robust. We are also building out a pathway for targeted innovation projects. I think of that as state-directed or maybe pre-packaged projects that are designed by the Department of Health to address gaps that we see arise, or to address priority areas, and that allows the state to be nimble and to move quickly and to you know, look across. You know, we write this, you know, 20 plus pages of here's what we all want to collectively do, and we're asking our community to say, well, what do you want to do? What are you prepared to do now? But then this is a way for us to also say, let's put some shape around some of these ideas and present you know, an opportunity that entities can say, yeah, that does look like something I want to do. So that's, I would say those will maybe be more forthcoming a little bit later. Our current focus really is on building out this foundational framework to allow, you know, our community participants to say that, you know, I would like to apply for some of these funds. I would like to move forward. We're really, you know, building up those pieces of the program, and then we'll fine tune as those pieces become established.
Can I ask sort of two related questions? The first is, can you provide any examples of those sort of state directed or prepackaged projects? And then secondly, you know, we get a lot of requests from constituents and ideas from constituents. They come to us, they come to our offices. Would you suggest us, either through our offices directly going to you or sending them to you and sort of pointing them to this source of funds for those kind of ideas?
For the record, Heidi Hedberg to the chair. I would say for the targeted innovation projects, yes, if there's ideas, please let us know. We've also opened the invitation to all of the various associations. Like, as an association with a group of providers, what are you seeing as the biggest pain points that applies statewide, and taking those ideas? And as Betsy Wood just illustrated, pre-packaging it and saying, here's a package, so it's easier for entities to say, yes, I'm going to take this instead of developing my own project implementation. So I think that the ideas certainly should come to the Department of Health so that we can definitely flesh those ideas out. To your earlier question of what are some of the examples, I would say maternal health is an example. What we see in communities is, you know, moms need to travel out earlier to deliver care. So what are some of those projects that we can work on to help moms stay in community longer before they have to travel out to deliver? Emergency medical services. I think this is a great opportunity to use Rural Health Transformation funds to really look at how do we treat in place or transport to an alternate destination so that we are only transporting patients to an emergency department when it is appropriate for the emergency department. So I think those are different concepts that need to be evaluated and discussed with EMS. I think of DC Ritchie. She had talked about remote patient monitoring, specifically around, you know, congestive heart failure as an example. That's another opportunity for us to look out. I think the ideas come from, it can come from you, it can come from associations, it can come from providers. We are looking at statewide impact. And we're also, I just want to call out, we have this lens of equal opportunity. So from the smallest nonprofit provider to the most robust organization that has grant writers, what's an equal opportunity to engage in some of these targeted innovation projects that has already completed, CMS has blessed. So now we can have entities across the state engage.
Very good. Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, you know, I think every person sitting at this table and even in the legislature says bravo to you for the application. And it's always exciting to have federal money. But at the end of the day, we also have to face paying the bill for this. And this is what I mean. Department of Health has not had a great track record on reporting and tracking this money, and this comes out every year in our annual single audit. Money wasn't reported appropriately, or it wasn't tracked, and therefore we get dinged on our federal federal reporting, sometimes accompanied by fines, which is where paying the bill comes in. This is a monstrous undertaking. Do you have the ability? Do you have the staff in place? What is your fiscal note for executing the management of this?
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, through the chair, Senator Giesel, thank you for that question. I would say that we are definitely learning from our lessons learned over the past 3 years since we've been in these positions, first and foremost. Second, we are creating 8 new positions within the Department of Health that is funded by the Rural Health Transformation Program. So we're not using general funds because these staff will be working full time on accounting and project implementation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Tillman.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess that leads me to the follow-up question. I'm a former employee at the Alaska Community Foundation, and I am very well aware of what their current capacity is. How many folks do they need to hire to be the subgrantee? And what is their particular administrative overhead in being the administrator of these funds?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, that's a great question. We just were able to announce that we've contracted with them as of yesterday morning. So I think they're still in that staffing up capacity, and they fully recognize that they will need to surge. I think there's like an initial surge capacity that they'll need to build in order to establish this project, and they're actively working on building out their team. I don't know offhand how many team members they have, but they're, I think, also learning from past experience and wanting to come into this prepared and ready to move forward.
Yes, Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Will they be able to use these funds to do that? And does that mean that there'll be less funds that go to the grantees because that they'll be using them to sustain positions?
Thank you for the question through the chair, Senator Tobin. Their contract will be funded with these rural health transformation dollars, but we look at that as part of those administrative funds that are necessary in order to really fully leverage and move the rest of the dollars where they need to go, the bulk of the dollars. I think we're trying to run as lean as possible on the administrative side, while also recognizing that if the administrative gears don't turn and don't work, then it's really difficult for the programs to succeed.
Thank you. Let's move on. We've got 2 more slides. We're running a little low on time. Perhaps we could stay a few minutes later if we have additional questions, but let's move on to slide 13.
Thank you. For the record, this is Betsy Wood. I can be really brief with this slide. I think this is just meant to provide an example of the type of information that we expect to see in those, full project implementation applications. It's really meant to just give a sense that we will be asking for information about the project and the work plan, pieces like that. And a lot of this is going to be driven by what do we need to communicate back to CMS so that they can have a full understanding of how we're building out projects.
Very good.
move on to slide 14. I can be brief with this. This is a high-level overview of what the application review process will look like. Again, applicants will be able to register with an online portal and provide their information ideally one time so you can say, this is who I am, and then start to build out those letters of intent to provide a shape of your project. That will help us route people into, you know, what may be the most appropriate funding opportunity or funding pathway. We'll review these applications, work with CMS to ensure that what we'd like to fund is aligned with what CMS's program requirements are, and then move forward from there. I think this is a high-level overview. A lot of people are really interested in the specific timeline for that. We are working every day to build out that timeline with specificity. And I would say, again, to watch our website. We'll be updating that as soon as we can, with more information for the public so they can understand when and how do they engage with this program.
The money comes presumably over the course of these 5 years. Do you intend to have a rolling application process, or will there be hard deadlines every year? What do you anticipate?
To the chair, we anticipate that there will be multiple opportunities to apply for these funds, right? You know, we have to work in terms of budget periods. So right now we're within the first budget period. We know how much we've been awarded for this year and able to spend through the next. Our next budget period will begin in October, so we'll need to do some pre-planning ahead of that to start to build out our continuing application that we turn into CMS to say, here's what we're thinking for next year. We also recognize, you know, we're working with CMS to provide budget updates as we go to say, okay, first we worked off of a planning number. Now here's our actual award. We're updating to that. But we recognize, as do they, that collaborative agreement and cooperative agreement really does have to be a lot of cooperation and very collaborative, because we're in the position of understanding that we want to, you know, deploy these funds across the state. We need to receive information from potential applicants for what do they want to do, so then we can communicate that back. So I think that there's going to be a lot of back and forth as far as what does that look like, where do we see those funds going, but absolutely there will be multiple opportunities for entities to kind of enter into that application cycle.
Very good. All right, I think we have one more slide.
Again, for the record, this is Betsy Wood. Just to remind folks, this is how you can find us, how you can stay in touch with us. We have a dedicated website on the Department of Health website, or a dedicated page on the Department of Health website. We're building out frequently asked questions as we receive them. I think I mentioned earlier we held a convening where we brought partners together, and we received, you know, over 400 individual questions that came in during that. And so we're synthesizing those and questions that we get from the public, from our partners, into what are the frequently asked questions where we can provide more information so people understand, you know, how best to engage and what do they need to know. We have a dedicated email box, and we will be updating our website frequently with information about different webinars, you know, learning opportunities, and we highly encourage people to sign up for updates.
So, do you have a question, Senator Myers?
Yeah, when you're done.
One of the questions here is, who can apply for the funding? Do they have to be Alaskan or Alaskan-based? And is there any preference given for example, if you are sort of most of the money that you're spending is here in Alaska versus an outside contractor you're bringing in from out of state, or is that not considered?
To the chair, Senator Dunbar, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. We are still finalizing kind of the evaluation rubric. We worked with kind of that key advisory group to develop that initial rubric that was included in the application, but we need to finalize that. And in future years, we plan to put that forward publicly and update that. Again, we want this process to be very public and open in terms of how these are being evaluated. I think right now we would expect that any application very clearly state how they are aligned with Alaska-based providers, right? I can't imagine an entity coming in and not having an alignment with an Alaska-based provider or organization that would be competitive for funding. Again, we are focusing on our Alaskan organizations and communities.
Very good. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's already the end of January. You've got until October to get this money awarded and sent out. So when is the letter of intent notifications going to come out, and when will the RFP process start?
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, through the chair, Senator Myers. So on our website, we are going to the goal that we have is we will be announcing a webinar because we want to educate everyone in Alaska how to apply with the registration portal and the letter of intent. So that will be coming very soon. Following that, we'll have a short period for the letter of intent, and then we'll evaluate those and then look for full proposals. So the information truly on a daily couple of days is continuing to be updated on our website, and we would point everyone to our website. We feel the urgency in getting the information out. But to the earlier questions, it's also being a bit thoughtful and making sure that we are thinking of all of the different we need to be making many considerations as we're making these decisions on making sure everyone's informed with the letter of intent and the process.
Okay. Thank you.
Very good. Senator Giesel.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to underscore a question that you just asked prior to Senator Myers. You know, when you held that convening in Anchorage, it was a gold rush of outside companies coming in. Oh, boy, federal money. And so I appreciate your answer that you will be looking at organizations already aligned with Alaskan providers. That's critical that the money is, in fact, used here and not simply handed out to outside entities. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. Their questions. We have a couple more minutes left, and I want to go back to something. We can go to the next slide. It says questions, but actually my question is based on the role of this committee and slide three, right, which is the legislative policy changes that is it right to say that you're asking for? I mean, is the Department of Health asking for these policy changes? I assume yes, because it was part of the application process, but there's been no formal sort of representation from the governor's office by putting forward the legislative request. My question is, I know you can't say to us yet sort of what percent of the money hinges on which of these policy changes. I know you don't really know that yet. Can you tell us when you might know that?
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, to the chair, we have asked, every state has asked the same question, and CMS has not provided that answer or when they would provide that answer. And so we don't know, but it is a question that is being asked. I would say that, yes, I think, you know, we heard loud and clear from Alaskans across the state to be competitive. And so I think yes, we are looking for those policies to be passed, but I think that there's education, there's evaluation that needs to happen. And so we have 2 years in order to have those conversations to evaluate, you know, what makes sense. And I fully respect that is within the legislative body and within this committee to have those conversations.
Senator Klayman. Thank you, Commissioner.
Maybe to put a narrower question, and you may not know the answer to this one either, but what I hear repeatedly is that the timeline to get these potential policy changes on page three is 2 years. And last I counted, the current governor has about 10 months. And so there's one response that one could have sitting in the legislature today saying, this sounds like a problem that's going to be the next governor's problem, not this governor's problem. And this governor's happy to kind of wait and let that get dealt with in 27, not in 26. Is that something that has been discussed within the executive branch as to whether this is a priority for 27 and not really worry about it for 26?
To the chair, Senator Klayman, yes, this is a priority, and we would love to see these policies passed.
But we don't really know the policies that we're supposed to pass yet.
Through the chair, Senator Klayman. So the compact licenses, 4 out of those 5 are with the Department of Commerce. And so Sylvan Robb is here. And so This is where we're all here together to make sure that they can speak to those compact licenses. EMS is within the Department of Health. And so, yes, we would love to see the EMS compact licensure passed. And there is legislation that has been introduced that is related to the pharmacy or to the scope of practice for pharmacists. And so that is already underway. So I think part of it is we see many legislators that are interested in seeing legislation introduced. I think we're waiting to see who is introducing legislation. There was another legislator that introduced one on psychologists. So I think that's part of the just period of time in the, where we're at today. But to your earlier question, yes, we'd like to see it passed this session.
So I have another question. I apologize to my colleagues and feel free to step out if you need to go. But I do think this is important because I think it drives a lot of the conversation we're going to have the rest of the session if we actually want to see these legislative changes. I don't actually know if these compact licenses are sort of an on or off switch or if there are different versions of this kind of legislation that can be passed, certainly within scope of practice. Do you have a in the promises made to the through the application process, was it a certain kind of change that you need to the scope of practice? Like, is that defined in a way that we can put into legislation? Or do you have model legislation that we can at least see?
To the chair, there was certainly specific requests. I think that, you know, you heard the commissioner say earlier that there are very specific pieces identified that states were asked to look at. And we can share that. It's within the notice of funding opportunity, but it's a little bit buried in there. So we can share that with the committee and point you directly to where those pieces are.
Could it be drafted into legislation? You see what I'm saying? Even if the governor doesn't introduce it, could you drive the legislative drafting process so we know exactly what it is we potentially need to pass? To conform with your application, to be clear. Mm-hmm. I mean, ordinarily we do legislating, but mm-hmm. certain promises have been made. We need to know how to, if we want to, we need to know how to comply with them.
I think what we can do is we can provide the information that was provided by CMS. And, you know, I'm not a legislative drafter, so I think we can say this is...
got reinforcements.
Courtney, right? Legislative liaison for the Department of Health. There is model legislation that is specifically linked for most of the compacts, and there's a specific link for what exactly is looking for in pharmacists, and I'll be happy to get that specifically to you for the committee.
I think I know the answer to this, but actually, maybe not. If we pass a version, but we diverge from the model legislation, do we still get credit? Do we get partial credit? How is that scored? How will we know? When will we know how that is scored?
So through the chair, Senator Dunbar, it's pretty specific that we have to join the compact. So each compact has specifications on how much variation can be made. So as long as we meet within the needs that each compact has and we are able to successfully join the compact, we should meet the needs we have in scoring. But I defer to Betsy if there's more details.
That's my understanding as well.
Very good. Do we have any follow-up questions? No, I've kept everybody long enough. We're going to have more hearings on this. We must if we want to pass this legislation. So thank you, Commissioner, for your time. Very much appreciate everyone's indulgence staying here a little later. The next meeting of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee will be Tuesday, February 3rd. We will have the department back. But this time for an overview, which will include updates on SNAP and Medicaid related to the passage of H.R. 1. Thank you, everyone, for a productive hearing.